welcome back to the Lumieres podcast with me, Jody White, and thank you for joining me, guys. Yeah, we're here again. We've got another conversation for you, and I do think you're going to enjoy it. I know I say that a lot. It's a bit of a cliche, but, you know, I wouldn't present anything to you that I didn't think that you might enjoy. So it's kind of a truism, hopefully. We'll see. But today's show is with Rachel Corby. Rachel Corby is a herbalist, medicine woman, plant whisperer. She's an author of several books. And I first heard about her work when I was gifted a copy of her book, Medicine Garden, for Christmas. And it contains a whole host of information about foraging and wild plants and making your own medicines and the importance of connecting with nature in that way, which I am a big believer in. And so I was drawn to her work and I followed her teaching over the last few years. And she offers some really interesting plant medicine work, rewilding retreats. And I just really liked the vibe of what she puts across. So she was on my list. She was on the big list that I drew up when I first started this project about all the people that, oh, wouldn't it be nice to sit down and talk to so-and-so? And my big list that keeps on growing and keeps on evolving and slowly ticking people off it. She was kind enough to welcome me to her place in Stroud, and we sat down and had a lovely conversation. And it was one of my favorite episodes I think I've done, actually, just for the way Rachel is just kind of so down to earth and approachable and friendly, and she brings her knowledge in a way that's really readily accessible, I think. And it was just a pleasure to have a chat with her, and I do hope that comes across in the conversation. It's sort of, there's some great depth to it. We kind of started off talking about her her introduction to medicinal plants and plant spirit work in South America when she was working over there and doing permaculture projects in the 90s. And she ended up working with a shaman in the Ecuadorian rainforest, which is interesting as an experience that I had in 2009 when I was in South America in the Ecuadorian rainforest. It's funny how these little connections join up, you know, as you go through life. There are little threads that dance through and connect you with other people. And Rachel is currently an author, a teacher. She basically works to reconnect all things wild and build relationships with the plants and the natural world and the human world. And she's the author of three books, the most recent of which is Rewild Yourself, Becoming Nature. And as I've mentioned, she leads workshops, retreats, apprenticeships and online mentorships. And she's just generally super cool. So I do hope you enjoy this conversation. When you next hear from me, I'll be hopefully settled finally in a new home in Wales. It feels like we've been moving on the brink of moving for months, really. And it's been a long drawn out process, but we finally got somewhere to live, and that is in sort of mid Wales area. I'm greatly looking forward to planting my feet in those lands, close to the mountains and the rivers, and just reconnect to the earthy side of myself a little bit more. So the next time you hear from me and the Lumieres podcast, we will be coming to you from deepest, wildest Wales. If any of you are listening who are based around Pristine, Hay on Wye, that sort of area, do please give us a shout and drop me a line. It'd be great to hang out and meet some people. Or if you have any suggestions of people who you know who are doing interesting work and projects around those areas, also drop me a line. It'd be great to hook up with some inspiring people and projects in the area that we're going to be living in. So if you want to connect with Rachel's work, her website is wildgaiansoul.com. And you can find her on social media under the name Mugwort Dreamer. She's on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, I think. And if you liked this podcast and you enjoyed it, I'd be ever so grateful if you fancied sharing it with your friends, your social networks. Helps me spread the word and helps this grow and helps me bring you more interesting and fascinating and hopefully thought-provoking conversations. You can find me if you want to connect with me. My social handle is Life in Fractals. That's on Instagram, facebook.com/lifeinfractals. The website is still ongoing, and that will be coming at some point soon when we're settled down, I imagine. And there's no music today. No music today. I didn't feel like it. Today just feels like a day for words and flowing straight into this conversation with Rachel. So sit back, relax, and please enjoy. So thanks for making time for me, and thanks for agreeing to sit down and have a chat. And it's funny, we've kind of corresponded digitally but not actually met in person a couple of times, and something about your work, I don't know what it is particularly, but just the something I felt quite drawn to about the way you work with plants. And maybe for people who, anyone who doesn't know what you do and that kind of thing, you could just say, introduce yourself.
Okay. Well, I think in a nutshell, what my work, what I aim to do in everything that I do really is to try and encourage people to come around to the awareness of the livingness of the world, of Gaia, of every other being that we're sharing this planet with. So it really, I mean, it starts with yourself and finding the wild place inside. But really what has helped me a lot in this kind of journey that I've been on has been connecting with the consciousness of plants. So a lot of my work is involved in kind of helping people, giving them little pointers, because we can all do it. We all came to this world communicating directly with our heart, with direct perception, just feeling without thinking, feeling without even using our senses, just kind of that direct feeling that a baby in a mother's arms would have. So it's a capacity that we've all got. So it's just kind of drawing people back to confidence and trust in themselves that they can do it. And so that when they are feeling things coming in from outside of themselves, they can go, hold on a minute, what's that? And where did it come from? Rather than thinking, well, I'm just making that up.
So what do your current work, what does that look like? Because I know you do, you offer courses and you run workshops and you do one-to-one things, and what sort of kind of aspects are you, or angles are you kind of applying that to at the moment?
I mean, you've got it. I mean, that's what I do really is courses, and I'm starting to actually, I'm ending up doing a lot more Skype sessions with people. I'm finding a lot of people not in the UK wanting to learn about this work and do this work. So I'm doing quite a lot of remote work through Skype.
How do you find that? You know, given that there's like this sort of artificial distance between, well, not literal distance between people, but there's, the communication channel is still there. How does that feel as opposed to working one-to-one?
It's there are challenges involved, and actually, luckily, so far, most of the people that have come to me in that way have already got a kind of a base level of experience. So working with somebody who hadn't done any work like this, I have done that, and they've ended up coming here for one-to-ones.
Well, that speaks volumes, I would say. That's nice.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it? With so much kind of therapeutic work, there's so much you can do. There's only so much you can do, I'd imagine, at a distance before it's helpful to work with someone directly. So how did you first come to, or when did your interest kind of take you in this direction? So were you always kind of interested in plants and in consciousness and that kind of thing? Or was there a moment that you thought, you know, there's something that I'm really drawn to about this?
I don't think there was a particular definitive moment, but there was quite a number, as I look back, there was quite a number of points which, you know, I think whenever you look back on your life path, that you always realise, oh, there was all these kind of golden threads that were drawing me through, leading me to this one place. I certainly remember working quite a lot with psilocybin. And at one point I was basically I felt like I was invited to sort some things out or to go away quite emphatically.
Wow,
and
okay.
And so I made a promise, really, that I would do my best to help sort out what's going on the planet. And but I'd always felt that. I mean, even from school, I remember, yeah, like in my geography class, I had this teacher, Mrs. Lamb, and I just remember we were a group of 16-year-old girls. It was a girls' school, and, you know, 30 16-year-old girls, I mean, you know, quite scary. But she was brave enough to stand in front of us and cry when she was talking about the Amazon rainforest and how it was being cut down. And she just stood there and cried, and it was just like, you know, it touched me so deeply. I thought, wow, this is something very serious, and, you know, something. So, and also my dad, previous to that, this is the 80s we're talking about, right? So I had a very spiky hairdo. And I used at least half a can of hairspray a week.
Wow.
And then my dad, and the crimpers every morning. Yeah. And my dad walked in one day. My dad's a scientist, he's a PhD, and he walked in one day and he said, "I'm banning all aerosols from this house." And I'm going, "What?" And it was way before all the information about the ozone hole had kind of hit the mainstream press. But of course, he was reading scientific journals and he'd read about it and went, "Wow, we've got to stop this." So he brought that ban in. So kind of little things were trickling in.
Nice. So did you, when did you sort of make a conscious decision to work more seriously, you know, exploring plants and your sort of plant spirit work and that kind of thing? Like, was that kind of going up through your kind of adulthood?
Yeah, I mean, I did a degree in geography, and after that I kind of went and I kind of wanted to, you know, explore a bit. And I went and I was working on various different environmental projects. It's still inspired by lovely Mrs. Lamb, my geography teacher, I suppose. But, and I kind of got involved in permaculture.
Okay.
And while I was on that kind of journey, I was in South America for quite a long time. And I just remember I'd read a book by Terence McKenna, and I kind of thought, hold on a minute, there's more to... I just remember actually being in, I can't remember what country it was, somewhere in South America, and it's very heavily wooded slopes, but very hilly.
Hmm.
And where the roads were, the soil was very, very red, and it looked like somebody had slashed flesh and it was bleeding, because all the red soil was kind of where the road was kind of running down. So it was like a bleeding wound. And I remember looking at those and just thinking, wow, you know. So I think during that South America trip was when I started to really become more and more inspired by plants and by being spoken to by nature quite clearly. Mm. And starting to really sort of go, It wasn't till a little bit later when I read a book by Elliot Cohen, who was working with plant spirit medicine. I thought, all right, I must study that. And then even before I'd started his, then I'd read books by Stephen Harabuna, and I was like, oh, I've got to study with him. So then I started to find human teachers who could help me kind of direct it a bit more, rather than just listening to plants or listening to landscapes even more, actually, and going, hold on a minute, something here's really wrong, and I can feel it and I know it and I can see it, but I don't know how to interpret it or what to do with that information. So I was helped along by studying with those guys, really.
Mm, and those guys are kind of like the guys, really. For anyone who's kind of researched this or read about it, those two people that you just mentioned have written some of the seminal works, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
And how, so they, they're both American?
They are both American, yes.
And did you travel to the States to work with those guys?
Elliot was and still is. I think he's just passing it over now to two of my friends, actually, to teach in the UK. But he did at the time travel to the UK each year to teach a group the medicine. But I did. I travelled to the States to study with Stephen, and I undertook a 1-year apprenticeship with him in New Mexico.
Wow. So what did that consist of, if you don't mind?
I was so lucky because I couldn't work, okay, because of the visa restrictions. I was I was also really lucky because the dollar was $2 to the pound at the time.
Those were the days.
So I just turned up and I got... cheap rent because I stayed with some people and I walked their dogs and cleaned their house. So I hardly had any living expenses. And actually later on, I ended up just house sitting on the edge of the Gila Wilderness, which is hundreds and hundreds, thousands, I guess, of acres of wilderness.
Whereabouts is that in the state?
In New Mexico. It's quite close down to the Mexican border, actually. Okay. And so I had nothing to fill my time apart from the work that Stephen was setting. So I think it was every third weekend we'd go from sort of Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I think we turned up on the Wednesday night, something like that. So sort of half a week, every 3 weeks, basically. And we'd go into the wilderness with him and he had a yurt and we'd just kind of sit there and he would talk to us quite a lot and then guide us through different things. And then everyone else went back to work and I just went back to the house I was house sitting or dog walking in and just lived the work that he taught. So
it was more of an immersion for
you. It was a full immersion.
That's how you get into those deep places of knowing, I guess, isn't it? By taking it into taking the time, taking the space to really go into that work. And then you brought that back to the UK. And when did you start kind of teaching and that kind of stuff?
Well, actually, even before I went out to the States, I went to the States in 2008, but I started studying with Elliot in 2006. And part of my training with Elliot involved some deep work with mug work. Mm-hmm. And part of that work was that you were asked, that I myself and everyone else in the group asked Mugwort for help with clarification of what our path as a healer was, bearing in mind we were learning to be a, to give treatments of plant spirit medicine. And actually Mugwort said to me, you're going to drum for people. You need to drum. You must drum for people, which to me meant like not as in getting a band and start like playing Rolling Stones tracks, but it was shamanic drumming and taking people on that journey. And I'm friends with Nathaniel Hughes, who's another great herbalist, intuitive herbalist and writer. And he was taking a group and he invited me to drum for that group. And so that was in 2006. So that's the first time I ever drummed for a group. And it just sort of carried on from there that I just started doing a weekly meetup journey group where I would go and meet with a spirit of a different plant each week. And then obviously when I came back from the States, I had a lot more sort of strings to my bow or whatever they call it. So then I started to expand it and actually do whole days. And then that's just built up over the years.
That's fascinating. I have a deep kind of connection with the drum as well, having been started as a musician when I was a kid, with a drum kit, and it's still a big love. But then when you use rhythm in that different sense to kind of entrain your brain, entrain your mind to access sort of a trance state.
That's right.
Such an interesting phenomena.
It is. I mean, I'm definitely not a musician by any stretch of the imagination. I used to think I had good rhythm until I went a few years ago to China and I was with some friends and we were at this nightclub and it had a really spring-loaded dance floor. It was like wooden, but it was really springy. And I realised that I was kind of kept getting bounced about because I was completely dancing out of time with everyone else. So I've got no rhythm whatsoever. But luckily, somebody else takes over when I do the shamanic drum and it does. It transports people. It's an amazing tool to help you just drop into the dream state, really.
Because I remember there was a real interesting transition or a really interesting point for me when I was kind of working with that a lot. Was drumming for yourself and really noticing that point where part of you takes a while to detach from the part of you that's drumming and is like, I'm thinking about drumming, I'm thinking about the rhythm, I'm thinking about my hands, I'm thinking about my arms aching. And then there's a point when you just keep it going and keep kind of breathing and keep moving away and keep your intention and you just sort of detach from your body. There's a real magical thing there where the drumming can just carry on and then you're free to kind of wander off.
Yeah.
I wonder if that is that because I've spoken to other people about this before, and they said they found it difficult to drum for themselves. And there was this thing versus drumming for a group, maybe, versus drumming for yourself, and then being able to kind of detach. And there's like the difference between holding space for other people and then just you're on your own or wherever you might be in drumming.
Yeah. I mean, it is very different when you're holding a space for people, holding the group, because you're kind of like, I'm also calling in the plant spirit that we're working with and asking for it to, you know, share its gifts with the people. And I'm really conscious of, like, you know, of the group. But then sometimes even then, so let alone when I'm drumming for myself, sometimes even then I'm just off, you know, it just takes me. So, I can't, you know, it is something I can do. But I think if I consciously sat there and tried to go, right, I'm going to wait till I go into it, it would just, my head would take over. So it has to be something that just kind of arrives.
Right. So in your work, you see, you kind of concentrate on meeting plant spirit through feeling, right? Through intuitive, yeah. but not through, because I remember one of the things you were offering recently was like a sort of medicine plant meeting where it was, but it's not doesn't involve ingestion or any kind of, you know, anything like that. It's a meeting of the plant in the space energetically or intuitively.
Yes. Because a lot of these plants, for want of a better word, I'll call them teacher plants, the entheogens, the ones that we know will change your consciousness when you eat them, even though actually also a lettuce or a nasturtium or anything else also does it if you really tune in. But I'm kind of quite concerned actually about what's the right word, the proliferation of the offering of these plants as medicine. In a way, it's wonderful because it's opening more people up, but it's also opening the door to people not doing it really with that much respect, also not harvesting the plants with ceremony or even sustainably. And also, you know what we are like? We're detached. The kind of British nation, we're kind of a nation of people who are quite detached, and so you like to get out of it even more. Do you know, people generally tend to, and you go to other countries and they're not quite the same as us. I was quite involved in the party scene for a long time, traveling around the world, and one of the nations of people that are well known for really just pushing it to the extreme would be the British people, whereas other people are a bit more like held together. So with that in the hands of British people, I think there are a lot of people, I call them joyriders, a lot of people out there, even though this medicine is very strong, that are still just going in there for the pretty pictures and not really taking it seriously. So the reason I then work with these great, amazing plants in that way is to show people that you don't have to do it. You don't have to ingest. Just to be in the presence of a plant will change your mood, will change your feeling state.
And for a lot of people, that's quite a radical thing to suggest.
Yeah.
Especially if they have no prior conception of what it means to communicate with a spirit of something.
Well, that's absolutely true, yeah.
How do you find people respond to that, or have responded in the group, the sessions that you've been holding?
Well, I mean, I suppose if they were really not thinking it was possible, they wouldn't have come. They would just thought that would be
sure. Yeah. Okay.
If they thought that was rubbish, they wouldn't have turned up. But everyone that's turned up has walked away with quite amazing. That it is. This is why I love doing it. It's like a high for me, because people walk away really just blown away and amazed, and just falling in love with wild and nature and plants more and more because of the experience they've had. And a lot of people come and they have ingested in the past, so they have got that experience, but they still are just blown away by how far they go just by working for a couple of hours just in the presence of a plant.
It's really fascinating, that is. And like you say, the effect of that rippling out, you know, if that's an opening point for people to see, to kind of connect in those ways, then it's like, well, obviously that can be applied elsewhere or everywhere, really, in your environment. I think it's really important. And what you mentioned about the dangers, the potential dangers of entheogenic substances that are sort of becoming more widely popular and more widely available without really the education or experience of people to hold and generate space for those things to happen is definitely a pitfall. Do you think people, I mean, it's a funny one, isn't it? I've seen people who've gone down those routes really seriously and have become, you know, I'd say less involved in the world rather than more engaged and maybe more, there's a trickster element at play in some plants. Yeah, would you agree with that?
I thoroughly agree with that.
Would you say plants have their own agenda in a way?
Yeah, I mean, they've all got their own different personalities and certain ones are definitely tricksters and they don't mind if they leave you messed up.
Mm.
You know, it's not all peace and love out there. We've all seen the nature documentaries, you know, things kill and get killed, you know. It's so some plants, you know, I mean, it's almost like, well, a lot of plants have got a sense of humour and some of them find it funny if they leave you upside down kind of thing. So, but I mean, I think the other point to this is you kind of touched on it in what you just said, that within its sort of like native context, if you're sort of within a community where a plant is taken regularly or as a sacrament or as some kind of medicine, there is a support network around it. And also it's always been in your life, whether you've gone and sort of like the way I sort of work with people, gone and sat with the plant, but certainly someone working with it, like a shaman or, for, you know, whatever they call themselves, a vegetalista or whatever, ayahuascaero, they would know the plant and they would know the plant in its living setting and they would know the character of the plant in the way that I kind of work with it before they start ingesting it, before they start giving it to other people, and have that deep, ongoing friendship and knowing about each other. And also within the community, you know, for everyone from, you know, the old man down the street to your mum to your brother, everybody would know that when you've taken that medicine, what may have opened up for you and so how to be with you afterwards.
Sure. Yeah, which is definitely not the case over here, I would say.
No, because I think a lot of people, you know, it's might well be their escape and it might well be their medicine, but you go back to the office on Monday morning, pretend you haven't done anything.
Mm. You know? It becomes like, yeah, just another way of escaping, just another way of disguising or kind of avoiding.
Well, I think sometimes you just don't get to process correctly or not correctly, that's probably a stupid word, but you know, you don't get to process sufficiently what happened and really think it through. Maybe that's why you then go and chase another experience, I don't know, because you haven't had the opportunity to kind of go, well, what actually, you know, to unfold it and what actually is in there for me.
Do you have any opinions on the sort of try and say that again, spread, that's a better word.
that's an easy one.
On the spread of of plant medicine, teacher plants, these kind of sacraments from other cultures, do you have any opinions on that, on the way that's sort of been spread around the world into cultures that haven't had that, you know, thousands of years connection with ayahuasca or peyote or whatever it may be? There seems to be a couple of schools of thought on this. People are saying, I've heard people say that you should only ingest plants in their native environment. Other people say, well, the plants told me that it's on a mission to spread itself around the world. Mm-hmm. And they're two extreme kind of views. And I just wondered if you, like, where you kind of chime in with that.
Yes, I have heard both of those. And I think sometimes I do understand the mission, and people say, you know, it's a mission. Certainly ayahuasca is mentioned a lot of kind of it wants to put the message out there, and I agree, you know, we need to be woken up, slap around the face. Come on, guys, what are you doing? You know, but I think once you've had that initial wake up, we have got plants in this country. And there are plants you can perhaps grow. I mean, it's kind of all starts to get a bit like fuzzy with regards to legality, but I think actually so is ayahuasca, isn't it? That's not legal. Yeah, so they are plants. If there are native plants that can help you. And actually, I tell you what, this is my whole thing as well, is yesterday I was teaching on a retreat and it was the end of a retreat. And so I thought I'll have a nice gentle plant to finish the retreat with. I wasn't using any entheogens all week. It was all just native plants. And so I finished yesterday using rose, because people quite often, most people kind of get the feeling of rose being a bit of a love and comfort and heart. But I had people crying. I had people opening up. It's so strong. The medicine of rose was so strong for people that I think you can have, okay, you're not going to have the visions inside your head. They're kind of like, which I think is what a lot of people really get excited about. But you can still get like life-changing experiences. That was from a cup of tea, by the way. Mm-hmm. It was a cup of rose tea. They didn't know what, they did know what they were drinking because they could smell it, but I just made people smell the tea and then taste the tea. And I basically had people just like ripping open. Mm-hmm. And that's how potent, if you give yourself time and space to notice what's happening in your body, that's what's happening just with a rose, you know.
And that seems to be, it kind of touches on the core, sort of one of the core problems, I guess, is that people in this sort of such fast-paced and impatient society these days, we don't have people don't seem to want to or have the time to give those sort of, to give plants the respect they deserve in that sense, where, you know, this is a cup of tea made from something from the garden or from even from a packet, you know, but observe that, you know, that before you drink it. How does it smell? All those kind of things, the sensory information, the physical information, and then anything else that comes up from the body when you've kind of...
Well, it's a lot less sexy, isn't it? And you have to work a little bit for it as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. But then, like, I guess, like all the best things, you know, that pays off in the end, because there's a deeper relationship and it can help on a deeper level.
And it opens you up to it. So, like, every time you go out, so the people that were there yesterday, every time they go out now and pass a rose plant, it's like, you know, just something like pings. Something will ping for them and they'll know they're walking past a friend and they will stop to greet it, whether it's a nanosecond in their mind, oh, it's rose, you know. But it opens up. So for the argument you mentioned before with the entheogens about having something local, that's what it's about. It's about then being able to connect with every single plant that you walk past and know that you're part of this living landscape rather than just a fast-moving human in your little shoes and your little car, forgetting that everything else is alive and can talk to you and can tell you and can help you and, you know, all of those things.
Yeah, it's such a sort of paradigm shift for a lot of people to even comprehend that, you know, coming from a sort of Judeo-Christian culture where those sort of beliefs have been deliberately suppressed over time.
Yeah, of course.
It's difficult, I guess, for people to jump into those sort of, or well, maybe the jump is something that is helpful. Like you said before, that, you know, sometimes there needs to be, well, sometimes right now, all the time, there needs to be something that can have an immediate impact.
Yeah.
But if that's not integrated properly and that's just kind of dismissed as an experience and on to the next one, that's where the sort of importance and the power of it is lost a little.
Yeah.
Fascinating stuff that is. I guess you work with many, many plants, but have you got any over the years that have kind of become like your sort of closest allies, as it were?
I have. And I found it very interesting, actually, when I was working with Stephen Buhner. He said, if the facts are wrong, blame him, not me. But he said there's amongst the Plains Indians of the United States, traditionally, very much so, that the medicine man of the tribe would usually only be working with a maximum of three plants, sometimes only one, and within that small number of plants, he had such a depth of knowledge of each of those plants that he could help out the whole of his tribe for most of the things that they ended up with.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. So with that in mind, that's not the reason I don't work with lots of plants, but I've kind of got, each year I kind of like, I'll open up to maybe one or two more, but that's it. And you think of how many hundreds and thousands of plants there are.
Yeah.
But I work so deeply with, you know, some, they just keep coming back and they're constant. And like, for example, nettle, stinging nettle, it's a plant that I've been working with for 13 years. And every time I work with it, or because I keep introducing it to a group, and each time I introduce it to a group, my knowledge just drops a bit deeper, and I'll always kind of do some work with it myself before I go mm-hmm. into the group. Mm-hmm. And so that will drop it deeper. And also every year, you know, some like this year, I had just such an urge that I needed to drink nettle all spring long. And I did for about 6 weeks. I had 3 cups of nettle tea a day, and then it's just been finished. It was like, I really don't tend to keep things out of season. So I use what's there. Mm-hmm. Of course I do. I mean, I've got an allotment as well. So I do harvest things for the other months. Otherwise, certainly midwinter, you're going to start getting a bit low on resources. Mm-hmm. But things like nettle, it's so amazing when it's fresh and young that I got my fill of it. You know, I was just so drawn to drink it, and every single day and every single day and every single day, that I wasn't drinking any other herbs, wasn't using any other herbs just for 6 weeks. I was just on nettle. And this is like 13 years in, I'm still drawn to actually. And when you do that, when you're just drinking one single herb, you know, of course it becomes you, because all our cells in our body are made by what we put into our body, of course. So I became just a little bit more nettle during that period of time. But my relationship with it deepened again. And that just keeps happening. So yeah, I've got like probably about half a dozen plants that are on that level that for years and years and years I just go back to, and I've got a medicine pouch that some of them stay in, some, you know, so I'm always kind of like, they're always there.
Yeah, I mean that sort of resonates with the idea that a teacher of mine once said about sort of every plant is a sort of university of its own, really.
Yeah.
You know, you can't. Yeah. You can't go to every university and study everything.
No.
Because the understanding just becomes diluted, because there's just not enough time, or, you know, maybe it's just a bit of a human overambition to sort of know about everything, you know, rather than specialise in something.
I always think of it being a bit like a cocktail party. So you can be, I don't know what that says about me, but you can be at a cocktail party and you know what it's like, you're at one of those events, you sort of like start having a conversation with someone, and then someone else comes along, so you end up talking to them and you never finish that first conversation, and then someone else is coming, oh, that person over there looks interesting. So you never actually get to the crux of the matter with anyone. Whereas if you went round to your friend's house with a bottle of wine and sat on the sofa and talked for 3 hours, you'd get so much more out of your interaction. So I feel like that with plants, really, you know, I'd much rather have that evening in on the sofa than kind of, well, you know, flirting around in I don't mind that as well, actually, having said it.
Balance.
But yeah, no, I thoroughly agree. I've got, you know, some people really, really want to know so many plants, and that's great. Maybe that's their path. They need to know a lot of plants for whatever it is, or maybe they just keep looking until they find one that can really speak to them.
Right.
Could be that as well.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you about, because I know that you use the word rewilding in your kind of website a bit. It's something that's become somewhat of a buzzword, I guess, recently. And I was just wondering what does that mean to you, and what are your reflections on the way that word is kind of being used to signify maybe, what am I trying to say here? Do you understand what I'm trying to say? I'm sort of having trouble wording the question, but I'm curious to see as to what your reflections are with that word and what it means to you versus, you know, how you see it being used and started to be a bit bandied around and that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, obviously, originally it was really used to talk about land and landscape and kind of reintroducing native species that were lost a long time ago. You know, there's evidence from, was it Yellowstone National Park, that they reintroduced the wolf, and then the whole, everything came down. You know, you look it up, dear listener, because it is very, very interesting and exciting what happened. Everything changed, the courses of the rivers, the bird life, the plant life, everything changed by reintroducing one species. But that's in a national park. My whole thing is that we've ended up in this... what do you call it, ecological global crisis or something. We are here because of people and because of our attitude and because of our behaviour. Was it Beavers, I think, somebody who introduced sort of on the sly in Scotland, I think it was Beavers, and the farmers just started killing them straight away. This was a couple of years ago, and they started killing them straight away because they started damming up the rivers, which, okay, environmentally would have had a better effect, but it's no good for their sheep in the field, and then it was, they were getting foot rot or whatever happens, you know, there was all this stuff. So they actually started shooting them, and I think last autumn it came in that you can no longer do that and that they're protected or something. I can't quite remember the actual statistics or anything, but that is my case in point, really, because it has to be the attitude of us and our relationship with wild nature that has to really take a fundamental shift before the rest of it can actually be done, because otherwise we're just imposing yet more on the landscape. That, you know, it may be deeply unbalanced as it is, but if we just go back to something that was hundreds of years ago last there, well, the landscape's not used to having it and people aren't used to having it, and so then it upsets everybody. Right. So my whole take on rewilding is about starting with yourself and starting with everything about yourself. So, I mean, I do talk a lot about senses, using your senses and resensitizing, because we're so used to not even using our physical senses or noticing how our physical body feels.
I think that's key.
Yeah, it is. And then once you start to do that, of course, it affects what you eat. And once you start thinking about what you eat, then you think about how it's grown and you think about how it got to you. And so it spirals out and suddenly... the environment does become a better place. This is the plan anyway. It becomes a better place because everybody's suddenly thinking more consciously about everything they do and the clothes that they wear and the things that they buy. Because if you're more connected yourself and you understand that when you're shut indoors and you're not going outside enough, you don't feel as bright or as well as if you have the opportunity to go outside. Obviously loads of people live in cities, but you've still got amazing parks and I've got loads of friends who live in London and we always go up and swim in on Hampstead Heath. They've got those ponds and just kind of go in and swimming in those, and you know, there's still great opportunities. There's that whole movement in London, isn't there, the national or the London Parks City kind of movement. Oh, you'll have to find them and interview them next.
I'm new to that.
But yeah, they're trying to make it a national park city or something like that, because there's so many little parks in London. And I know not every city is the same, but that's some of the richest biodiversity is actually within urban environments, certainly for things like bees. There's a lot more bees and butterflies often actually in a city, because they haven't, even though there's all the pollution and everything else, those little pockets in people's back gardens are such like refuges for wildlife, as opposed to the kind of stark farmland areas which are full of chemicals and they don't have an opportunity and no wild plants, because they've all been, you know, all the herbicides have been used. So you know, there's opportunity to make that connection wherever you are. And if you've got a garden, even better, because you can just sit out there and you can let your garden run a bit wild and don't worry about what your neighbours say and just sit in amongst it and observe all the nature, all the little critters that come and crawl on your body, lie back in the grass, go barefoot. There's so many opportunities. And with each one of those, you come a bit more alive. That's my experience, you know.
Wow, I've never heard it kind of put so so eloquently. You just nailed it.
Oh, good.
That was fantastic. It's a funny thing as well, isn't it? Because, I mean, it's also for me, it seems a bit about becoming more in tune with the fact that we're also animal as well.
And,
and that there are animal parts of us that that we sort of don't like to look at or acknowledge. And yeah, it's just another way to, as you put it, sort of gain an awareness, isn't it, of our bodies, of our beings, of what makes us human, and what makes us, how we connect to the wider world around us.
I mean, I think the most important thing for me in where, I mean, it's sort of an evolution for me, sort of like my work, and because it's sort of just my life, you know.
Yeah.
And the most important thing is what we've just been speaking about, which is the rewilding, and about kind of taking that to another level, finding a deeper way, and how to work with that with people so that you can draw it into your daily lives. Because like 2 years ago, I started running a rewilding apprenticeship. And actually, even on the first weekend, they're going, oh, no, it's not going to be long enough. We need a second year. And I've just been, next week, actually, I'm going to work with those first year apprentices again. And it's for them now, it's like I've given them all these tools, but they're still sort of like, well, how do we, I've called it weaving wildness that week, because it's like, how do we then weave it into our daily day to day? And I think it's quite hard for people to find those little ins or to recognise. And so, I mean, for me, it just sort of it's an unfolding and it's happening, and I'm aware. But I think partly because of all that work I did during my apprenticeship with Stephen Buhner, I kind of really learned how to kind of unlock all those human things, you know, when you're human. So I think this is what you were trying to say before, actually, about sort of we've shut a lot off from ourselves, and the animalness about us we've shut off. So part of that, going back, is the senses and eating, and the more you kind of tune into them, the more you tune into yourself. But also it's sort of like our emotional and that side of ourselves, because you sort of to be an acceptable human.
Yes, and especially if you've been born British and you're oh so polite and oh so keen to not offend anybody, or
absolutely,
you know, just keep the stiff upper lip. Yeah, let's not talk about it in front of your mother.
That's it. You must not raise your voice. You must never cry in public, even at a funeral. You know, I mean, the amount of times you see people at a funeral chewing their bottom lip, not even just letting it go, and you're like, oh my goodness, you know, if you can't cry now. You know, and that's what you need to do. And I think it's, I mean, not saying that you walk around and see loads of foxes and badgers crying, but but they're not bottling it up either, you know what I mean? And of course they operate in a different way, but I think that is a really, what I'm starting to discover, actually, is I think through work with my students and my clients and everything, is that it's being able to unlock that, which will open the door to everything else. And so I guess that will be where my work will be heading a little bit, just trying to find other ways of kind of really getting people to look inside. And actually, before we started recording, we're talking a little bit about the shadow, weren't we?
Yeah.
About exploring the shadow and exploring those things that that you lock away. And I think those parts of ourselves, the scary parts, the times where we're very afraid or very upset or very angry, those parts that we've locked away, they're still part of us. So if we don't acknowledge that they're there, then that's not very healthy. But if we acknowledge that they're there and see what gifts they can offer us, what gifts of insight deep grief can offer us, or deep anger, you know, extreme rage, or, you know, all of those... you know, even sometimes people get told off. I remember as a child getting told off for being too excited when we were going on holiday. Like, calm down. You know, I was like, hey, on holiday. It's just like, calm down. It's like, you know, so all of our emotions, we've to be an acceptable human, we've squashed them back.
There's a lot of suppression.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And I think that is massive key to sort of opening up to the rest of nature and opening up to your own wildness. If you can own all of those parts of yourself and you know, let them come out to play, let them, you know, obviously you don't want to punch someone in the face. that really wouldn't look good, but you can still
I'm
be
just
angry.
Expressing my anger.
Yeah, it's just a healthy thing, you know.
You just happen to be there.
but it is. I mean, anger, if you look at what anger actually is, anger is an energy to get things done. It's like, you know, if somebody treads on your foot, you need to push them off before they break your toe. So
it's a protective mechanism.
Yeah, it is. And as long as it's in balance, and the reason I think sometimes things get out of balance is because they are put in that box, you know, and suppressed and subdued, and then until finally something just makes them snap and they burst out and, you know, turn into a horror story and make you really embarrassed, and then you have to put them back in really quickly again. You know, it's that. So and I think plants can help us with that. You know, they can. It's I found working with encouraging people to work with an ally plant, working with ally plants myself. What I mean by that is if you've got a really pressing issue. So for example, maybe you've got grief, maybe you lost a loved one or something and you can't express it and you know it's going on in there, but you're too frightened to really look into the depths of that grief because you're frightened you'll never come back out again, for example. You know, you can go out and ask a plant to help you. And I mean, of course, you've got to be slightly sensitive to it, but there's no real training. You see, like I said, right at the beginning, anyone can do it. So you can sit there, you can go and you can look for a tree to sit under and find a nice tree that feels nice and safe and just have a good old cry. And it could be that it's that tree that wants to help you. If you're going out with a genuine, very clear intention of that you need help in a certain thing, I need to learn how to express my anger in a way that's not going to hurt other people, for example. You know, if you have a really clear, you can write it down and be really, just so you really know what your question is, and then just go and look for a plant that will help you with it. Don't bother with what the herbal books say. Just throw them out the window. That doesn't matter. It's not about that. It's about just finding a plant that just when you're in its presence, you feel better. And then from there, you can take it deeper and you can take it further and find out more. And if you want to, at some point, open the herbal and go, oh my goodness, that plant's for depression. I can start drinking the tea of it.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. Yeah. And then the learning becomes internalized rather than, you know, intellectual or reliant on looking it up or on someone else's authority, I guess.
Yeah.
Because that's another kind of thing in this sort of realm is the adjustment into taking the power for yourself to make those decisions rather than relying on, oh, well, the book says this is, I should have this because this is good for this. And it's like, well, actually, you know really in your body what you really need and for your particular situation.
The problem is that we've all been brought up without being taught that we're trustworthy. So, you know, when you're at school, there's rules so that you don't do anything wrong, you don't upset anyone. Your parents have got rules for you. I mean, they tell you who you can be friends with, what food you can eat, what time you've got to be in, all of those things. Society, you know, everyone talks about nanny state rules and things like that.
Yeah.
Even in Waitrose car park the other year, they had this thing, don't walk under here because it's a conker tree and you might get hit by a conker. I mean, that was actually a genuine sign in my Waitrose car park. Yeah, I was pretty shocked. I did put it on Instagram, so I was so shocked. But that's how far it's descended that you can't even look at a tree and think, oh, there's a conker up there. It might fall and land on my head and I might get a small bruise. So it's that trust, and it's learning to trust yourself, because I think we're so used to not trusting ourselves that you kind of think, I don't know about this. I don't know. So you rush to a book to reconfirm it, and that's kind of okay. But I would say, you know, do that as the last thing, as the very last thing, and you know, it's like, how do you learn to trust yourself again? But I suppose that is one exercise I do a lot with people, actually, is getting them to tell me how they feel with a certain plant. And then later I'll tell them what the actual known properties, in inverted commas, actually are. Okay. And then everyone goes, no way, I got that. And I go, there you go, see, you can do it. But had you been told, right, you've got to go and tell me what the properties of that plant are, you'd have just been like rabbit in the headlights, I've got no idea. So, I mean, it is in all of us. And so little things like that, those little tests, you can do it on each other, right? You can get a friend and get a herbal tea. Okay, so this is a little exercise to do at home. so get one that obviously that you know is okay to drink, something that you would buy in a tea bag from a health store, for example, so you know it's not going to kill you. And you make a cup of tea for your friend, and then you get them to tell you, just from smelling it, and then afterwards just from tasting it, where it goes in their body, how it makes them feel. Do they feel it in their, you know, tummy or in their head, or is it more of a kind of uplifting feeling, or does it make you feel a bit more drowsy? Go for something that's not an obvious one as well, so one that they would instantly recognize, because then that ruins it because your head takes over. But if you do that, and then you can take turns and you give your friend a different tea and they try it, and then you both look it up at the end, and it's amazing. It's amazing how much your body wisdom will tell you, and your senses, even though we've got like really atrophied senses, our senses are terrible compared to people who live in the forest, you know. But we have still got our senses there, and they will still pass on information to us. So that's a great little thing to build trust in yourself. Just, you know, and I think that's a massive issue for most people, is actually trusting themselves.
That's so right on, I think. Do you think it's easy for people, or I say easy, we touched on before about, you know, you need to do the work on yourself. You need to, you know, there's a point where it's not just an experience. There's a prolonged commitment to discovering, you know, what it is that's going on for you. And you were just talking then about the sort of the exercise as a way of opening up into that. Do you think people can, how do you think people who are sort of very much embedded in the current status quo of the 9-to-5 system, how, you know, apart, we touched on the sort of the park thing and the wildness around us and the wildness in our gardens. Are there any of the practices that you employ that you would recommend people to try for that sort of, I guess, self-awareness in a way, isn't it? It's almost touching on mindfulness and meditation and that kind of thing. And it's all interconnected, of course.
Yeah.
But are there any particular techniques that you use in your teachings to kind of draw people back to themselves in that sort of respect?
Well, I think one of the most simple and basic things I do, and I do it myself as a practice every morning. And when I've got a residential group, I try and encourage everyone to do it in the morning. Obviously, different times of year, you're going to do it in a slightly different way. But because if at all possible, I recommend taking your shoes off and your socks off and standing on the ground barefoot. And then, so it's really about your place in the universe, this. So I recommend standing barefoot outside near some plants, okay, and then really wiggling your toes, spreading your feet out, and really thinking about everything that's in the soil. There's something like, I've written it in my book, I can't remember the number, something like 1 million pieces of bacteria and 1 million fungi in every teaspoon of soil, something along those numbers, actually more, I think. So there's so many life forms in every piece of soil beneath your foot. Also, you're standing on grass, you're standing on weeds or plants, lawn plants. So, and your skin is not an impermeable barrier. It is, we're all made of atoms, which are just basically a lot of air and vibrating particles. So everything we come into contact with, we are exchanging with, and that is becoming us. So, okay, so you're standing barefoot, so you're thinking of all these things beneath you, and then you can look up and look at the sky and all the things above you, the stars and the moon if it's at night, or the clouds and the sunshine if it's the daytime. And then just focus on your breath, because the one thing about your breath is it connects you to every other single living being on this planet. So with every breath you take in, it's laden with oxygen that has come from plants. And every breath you put out, I mean, it's obvious stuff. It goes back to biology at school, but every breath you put out is laden with carbon dioxide, which is then necessary for the plants to live. Oxygen necessary for us, carbon dioxide necessary for them. So it's not just, you're not just taking, you're also giving. And it's a reciprocal arrangement. You know, you're sharing with every breath. And also that breath is breathed by every other mammal, every other breath-breathing thing. So, you know, your dog, your cat, the birds, everything else is also sharing this breath. So I just like to sort of like myself, I like to just think of the plant and me and just kind of really with gratitude think about this cycle. And it really brings it to me, it really brings me back to myself and my place within it all, rather than an isolated unit.
Yeah, my place within it all. And there's this one of the most sort of depressing things about the way that things have gone in some respects with regards to human development of the world is that idea that we are more important than everything else. You know, that humans are the pinnacle. We're the top of the food chain. We're the most important. We're the cleverest. We're the best. We're the best. Yeah. And we can do everything and it doesn't matter. And, you know, the rest of the world is just a benign kind of nature, is just a benign background to our development in a way. You know, that is kind of what the way things have gone, especially since the Industrial Revolution.
Totally, yeah.
And it seems to me what you're just talking about is completely about reversing that and rewiring those kind of we're at the top of the food chain, we're important perspectives, and then putting humans back in the place of no, actually we are an element in a system which is way bigger than us and incorporates all these aspects, you know. And then you can even go on beyond planetary, you can start going to the cosmos and, you know, a place in the universe, and it can start getting pretty far out. But at the same time, I think it's healthy to encourage those kind of perspective shifts and really like de-importantize ourselves. Just reduce the sort of self-importance that is all too common, you know, in modern humans, especially in the Western world, I guess.
Yeah. I actually find, I mean, I love nature documentaries for their beautiful imagery, and the camera work these days is just,
it's stunning, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. However, I have to turn off the commentary because you'll get this thing and you've got, for example, I remember a few years ago watching this documentary where the dolphins were surrounded. I mean, everyone knows dolphins are intelligent, right? yeah, I hope so. And anyway, they were blowing up little bubbles of air and they were circling around to catch fish. I mean, they were creating a net with bubbles and then catching the fish. And the commentator said something like, and it is thought that perhaps dolphins contain some intelligence. And I was just like, turn the thing off now. I cannot watch it. It's just like, what do you mean? These are amazing beings. Look at what they're doing. You know, just because they're not driving a car.
Yeah. So it's all through the lens of humans, the pinnacle of intelligence, you know. I think it's so vital that people such as yourself are out there putting forth a different, you know, a different way, or the way perhaps the original way we used to feel and interconnect with the world, and with that awareness of where we were in the system and how things are affected, these small changes that we made affected, but it's just spiraled so far out of control now that there needs to be more and more wake-ups. Do you think, do you have any sort of feeling on the current sort of climatic crisis that we're in, and do you see it kind of going either way, or are you just sort of, well, I'm just going to be with it and do my part? And
I think the one thing that I've taken for myself is I can't try and save the planet. Yeah. because if I try and start thinking like that, I just end up stuck and panicking and thinking there is no hope, it's awful, it's terrible, we're never going to manage it. And I mean,
the cliche, isn't it, of putting the world on your shoulders, though, in a way. You crumble under that weight. You're like, no one can carry that.
No, exactly. So the only thing that I can do, and there are other people who would most certainly disagree with this and who will be doing amazing work in the world as well, so this is just my perspective, but the only thing I can do is work for myself and make my life a better life and use less of the resources that are creating the problems. I mean, the big thing now is, of course, the plastic in the oceans. And
still the water supply, you know, they've kind of found all these microplastics in the tap water, you know.
Yeah, and so, yes, I do still buy single-use plastic, sometimes really unconsciously sometimes. I'm still trying to tune myself into being more conscious about it. But no, I'll come home and I'll use something. Oh, no, that's single-use. Oh, no, I can't believe I've done it. So it's just trying to bring my awareness to me. I don't know if I can, you know, maybe I can also write to Coca-Cola and say, please go back to using glass bottles. And that would probably be very useful as well. But in the meantime, just to me to be conscious of what I'm actually doing myself. Because otherwise, you know, I do tend to kind of get overwhelmed by the thought of the largeness.
Yeah.
By the largeness of the whole of the environmental issues.
And I think anyone who deeply feels these things would do. You know, it's not. It's very understandable, you know. I know people that have struggled with this sort of issue, you know, like, oh, there's so much going on. Where do I start? You know, what do I do? And I think it does, like you say, it completely starts with you and your life and the people around you. And I'm a massive believer in, and have seen the effects of the ripple, you know, the ripple effect, so-called, where these changes happen and they filter out to people around you. Suddenly your family are doing things differently and they're talking about concepts that before they had no idea about. Your friends are changing their habits.
Yeah.
Someone's asking you about meditation because a few years ago you did it and they remembered about it. And, you know, all those kind of things, I think, and they're not to be dismissed. You know, it's not, obviously there is a place for direct action and there are people who are willing to do that, which is great.
Definitely.
And very much needed as well. But there are a myriad of ways that we all feed into the web.
Yeah, I thoroughly agree. And so, I mean, that's kind of how I'm coping with it, I think. Mm. You're right. Direct action is also a kind of, it's amazing when people go up there. I mean, all that, I'm sort of like into Greenpeace and that, so I'm always aware of when they're doing their big climbing up a big tower block or bridge or something and putting a banner up, and I'm just like, wow, those people are risking their lives and their freedom to make a statement, and those statements do change things. So it's brilliant that they do that. And I suppose I'm supporting them by putting money in there, but I'm not climbing that building myself because I'm a scaredy cat. But
I think there's a degree with which we can participate in that kind of thing and stand up more. And I think there's definitely a call for people to get out and voice, you know, more, especially in number, in the form of whatever that may be, with protests and campaigns and you know, there's many avenues you can take with that these days. But
I mean, I'm a firm believer in working for the things you believe in rather than against the things you don't believe in. Because when you sort of, like, I have been on loads of protests, right? And I mean, there was one in particular, I think that was the last one I went on, which was against the Gulf War when Tony Blair was in. And the newspapers reported that, I don't know what they said, a million people came out to march or something. But me and my friends, we weren't at the front, and we marched for ages, and we got just towards Hyde Park where they were doing the speeches at the end. So we popped in a pub, we had a couple of pints, we weren't quick, we took our time, we came out, and it was just as many people going past as were an hour and a half earlier when we'd gone in that pub.
Wow.
There were so many people, and it was just completely ignored and happened anyway. And at that point, I think that was because up till that point, I'd been on loads of different marches and protests, and even actually when I was younger, little bits of direct action about animal rights and things. But I'd done all of those things, and actually it was all still happening. So then I thought, okay, so what's the alternative to that? And the only way I can think is to what are the alternatives, and to work towards them becoming reality by drawing them into my life, and, like you say, allowing them to ripple out. And your friends going, oh, why are you using that? And you're saying, well, because I don't want to use single-use plastic. Oh, really? Oh, well, that's a really good idea. Yeah, I must get one myself. Or, you know what I mean? So I think, you know, it's not as strong, and I don't think, you know, I don't think anything's enough. Sure.
Yeah.
But it's a way, and it's the way I'm kind of choosing to work at the moment, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a difficult one for everyone, I think, to kind of find out how to navigate that.
I think awareness is a massive thing, you know, just drawing people's awareness to it.
Awareness, and also maybe like the expression of grief around it. People probably have, you know, it's like a friend of mine who I did a podcast with a few episodes back, Andreas Cornaval, and he was talking about the movement he set up called the Life Cairn, which was about grieving for extinct species and having
so
it's a point of reference. He's created these this concept where there's a space is created and then held for the expression of grief, basically, around extinct species. And I think they're doing something. I read the other day in Brighton there's some drive to have a like remembrance day for extinct species.
So this is great, because this is going right back to what we were saying before about people kind of putting their emotions and their feelings and all of those things away and not allowing themselves to feel, mm-hmm. because that flood of feeling, whether it's anger or whatever it was, would be overwhelming. But if you were allowing yourself to express that feeling, then that's a motivation, isn't it? Mm-hmm. If you stood there and everyone in Brighton stands around and holds hands and cries because of all these species that have gone extinct in the last year, because there will have been quite a lot in a year.
Every day.
So if people can feel that intense emotion, that's a massive motivator to then go out and you know, find a way to go, okay, this has got to start. I'm going to buy 5 acres of rainforest and put an electric fence around it and hope for the best.
Completely. It all comes back to feeling and opening up to our feeling and being honest with that, I think, and just taking away all those layers of sort of protection. In so many ways.
That sounds like great work he's doing, your friend.
That seems like a good place to bring things to a close. So If people are interested in your work and what you do, Rachel, where would you direct them to learn more about it and perhaps kind of, see what else you offer?
Well, my website is, it's called wildgaiansoul.com. On there is all the offerings that I'm currently putting out there. And
what have you got? Is there anything particular that you've got upcoming over the winter, or that you're excited about? Any courses or any little short things? Or
I've got I haven't got that much going on in the winter, because obviously the plants kind of die back and everyone draws their energy inwards, including myself. but in the spring I've got starting, it's a like a mentorship, a guided mentorship on sacred plant medicine. So it will kind of give you lessons, like little MP3s and videos and things of kind of how to get going, and then personal Skype consultations with me through the course of like the year, basically. So that's because I've had so many people who are remote, who can't come in person to one of my workshops. And then I have got, obviously later in the year, I've got like residential workshops, sacred plant medicine, and also a kind of rewilding retreat as well. I'm writing another book, you see, so I'm kind of not running my apprenticeship, but I will be running it again in 2019.
So what are you writing about,
basically? Only about 3 pages so far. only joking, but really about how the connection with plants can deepen your connection with your own wild nature, and you know, so it's a kind of just a movement forward from what I've been writing about before, but just going deeper into where you can go with plants and how they can guide you and help us back to where we're supposed to be, our real place amongst our other relatives, the relatives on this planet that we don't recognise at this point as relatives, really.
Wow. Yeah. Have you got any sort of timescales for that? Have you put any restrictions on it, or are you trying to get it done by a certain point, or are you just sort of writing and seeing?
Well, what I've discovered since running the apprenticeship is that while I'm running an apprenticeship, I'm holding space for that, which takes actually a lot more energy than I realised. Even when I'm not with the people, I'm still doing quite a lot of work. So I'm taking a year off from running the apprenticeship, and I thought, well, within that time, I'm going to use that time to write the book. So hopefully, I should hope that all the words will be done by this time next year at least. And then, you know, then it's all the other bits of processing that take a while to get it on the printed page. But yeah, I should imagine, hopefully, by 2019, it will be out. When are we now? 2017. Oh, so yeah, the whole of next year, kind of doing it.
And of course, we didn't really mention it much, but you already have several books out, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, my most recent one, Rewild Yourself, Becoming Nature. I mean, that's the kind of the progression, because my first one was a book about just about medicinal uses of plants, really. That was quite magical. How that came about. I just finished
The Medicine Garden.
That's called The Medicine Garden, yeah. And I just finished my work with Stephen Buhner, my apprenticeship. And while I was there, as I said, I couldn't actually work because of visa restrictions. So I wrote an article for a magazine back in the UK. And I just finished my final weekend with Stephen, and I went to San Francisco. I was flying back to the UK from San Francisco, and I checked my emails because there's no connection when we were out in the wilderness. And a publisher had emailed me and said, "Would you like to write a book based on that article?" And I'm like, "Wow,
that's amazing!"
It's amazing, wasn't it? And it was just like the plants, I think, believe were reaching out to me and saying, "You know, don't let this go. You know, stay with it." Huh. And so that was my first book, but it was. Kind of directed by the publisher, so it was really just a practical, useful field guide. But I have made it so that it's very accessible, because I think most herbals are, you can use it for this, this and this, but it then doesn't tell you how. So I just wanted to make it like, well, you make a cup of tea or herbal oil.
Yeah, completely.
So that's my books, yeah.
Oh, exciting. And is all the information about your books somewhere to get them on your website as well?
Yeah, you can get them on my website, or alternatively, you could just go somewhere like Amazon and just search for my name and they'll pop up, yeah.
Brilliant, cool. Well, yeah, I highly encourage people to go and check out Rachel's work. And thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been great speaking with you.
Thank you.
Yeah.